Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it. Chief Justice Gilbertson is participating by telephone. He has designated the Honorable Richard W. Sabres as presiding justice in the courtroom.
As you can see, we have an empty space up here, so if you get a question from out of the dark, you know where it's coming from. Starting over, this is the case of Michael Frisky and others versus Timothy Hogan. The attorney for the defendant and appellant is Mr. Gary Pashby, and the attorney for the plaintiff and the appellees is Mr. Lee Schoenbeck. Mr. Pashby, go ahead. Have you got the clock started?
I'll start it.
Okay.
May I please report, counsel? Issue was joined in this case on September 10, 2004. Needless to say, it's been a rather quick trip here, and we trust it's the end of the journey, rather than an instruction to return to go, so to speak. Involved here is a will that was executed on February 15, 2002 by one Douglas Frisk. Mr. Frisk and his wife, Jean, it was a second marriage for each. Both had children by a prior marriage, Mr. Frisk, some seven children of his own, and then the two of them had one in common. Following their get-togethers, a will was drawn, a will was executed, and it involves four separate parcels, two quarters, and then an 80 and a 100-acre plot. The 80 and the 100 apparently went without incident, in that they are now held, according to a life estate, by Jean Frisk, or in Jean Frisk, with the remainder of the seven children. The two quarters, however, unbeknownst to Mr. Hogan, were the subject of a deed that dates back to 1989. A deed at which time Jean Frisk and Mr. Frisk deeded to the two of them as joint tenants and not as tenants in common. So as they say, that those two particular quarters passed by operation law. Now, the seven children by Mr. Frisk's first marriage are parties plaintiff in this proceeding. The child that was born as a result of the marriage between the two of them, Jean and Douglas, is not a party plaintiff. Similarly, as I understand it, no action has been brought against her of any kind to set aside this deed that goes back to 89, or impress it with any kind of a trust or anything of that nature. This action merely is against the attorney who drafted the will. Now, appellees.
So what's your point there? They're trying to take advantage of a situation and basically obtain a double recovery?
I don't think I'd go so far, Your Honor, to suggest a double recovery. But I think I would be less than candid with the court if I said I do not find it interesting that there's no claim or no action of that nature pending. It's simply against the lawyer, and simply against the lawyer for a duty that at this point does not exist in the state of South Dakota.
Are you suggesting that the action against the attorney is premature and that there should be a preliminary proceedings involving the validity of that joint tenancy deed?
That certainly would be a preference, Your Honor. And depending upon the outcome of that case, would indicate whether or not this kind of an action should be forthcoming. Mr. Hogan, excuse me, the appellees in their brief state, Mr. Hogan was negligent in the provision of his legal service. He failed to advise and address consequences of the joint tenancy. He failed to perform legal services. All those questions relate to the breach of a duty, which are certainly one of the issues that would need to be decided upon remand in the event that's the position this court takes. Those issues are not before this court, and those issues have never been determined. The sole issue is whether there is or is not a duty under circumstances such that exist in this case. In other words, a duty to third persons, persons who are beneficiaries under a will, and persons who are not your client. This court has said time and time again that before there's a duty, there has got to be an attorney-client relationship. You even reaffirmed that, notwithstanding the discussion in CAMH about restatement section 51 of the law governing attorneys. You reaffirmed that position in that case, that there still is and exists a duty only to the client. You know, counsel now is suggesting that we apply Iowa Supreme Court case of Schreiner versus Scoville. That case was decided in 1987. I don't even know if a restatement existed of the law governing attorneys at that time, but that case didn't even mention the restatement. This court in CAMH, notwithstanding its discussion of Section 51 of the restatement, to the best of my recollection, did not even discuss Schreiner versus Scoville. And notwithstanding other opportunities to discuss this case, to my knowledge, it never has. Now all of a sudden it should be adopted as the law of the state.
Mr. Bashby, it seems to me though, Schreiner didn't specifically mention the restatement, but if you look at the analysis, it seems to me that they apply essentially the same kind of thinking or the same kind of factors that the restatement looks at to determine whether an exception to the duty or the absence of a duty.
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor. I think that's a fair statement.
So if the court were inclined to adopt the exception, I couldn't tell from the briefs whether it was more unpalatable to you to adopt the Schreiner logic or to adopt the restatement logic.
More unpalatable?
Which is better, which is worse, I guess is an easier way of saying it.
I'm not convinced that it makes a whole lot of difference. I think there's a three-part test enunciated in the section of the restatement for the law governing attorneys, section 51, I believe it is, and subsection 3. That probably more clearly enunciates what the intent was. And if this court goes to that extent, then I submit it should be according to that restatement rather than Schreiner, because it's a much clearer enunciation of what is required and what a lawyer need do. I don't think that it's going to help a whole lot, because I think there are all kinds of issues and it's fraught with problems.
If that's the case, if the restatement rule is the rule that should be looked at more seriously, is the status of this record clear enough to make the duty decision, or is there any factual development that needs to be made to decide whether a duty exists under those factors?
I don't think the status of the record is quite frankly clear enough, Your Honor. We came here rather quickly on the heels of some interrogatories having been served, a document request having been served on the defendants, which they answered, on the plaintiffs. which they answered. One served on us, which we objected to for the reasons of attorney-client privilege. That's never been decided. I just talked to Mr. Schoenbeck in the record, or this morning before we started. Unfortunately, it's not even a part of the record, the ages of Mr. and Mrs. Frisk. It's not a part of the record.
This matter be remanded to the trial court because we have an inadequate record to review the issue before us?
Let me put it this way, Your Honor. I would feel much more comfortable, if there's any question in your mind as to what you want to do, I would feel much more comfortable if you did that and decided this issue on the basis of a complete record rather than one, quite frankly, has some holes in it.
Which of the three restatement factors probably needs more factual development?
Probably all three of them, Your Honor. I can see evidence being taken on all three issues, relevant evidence, in the depositions of Gene Frisk, in the depositions of the parties plaintiff in this case, the deposition of Mr. Hogan, the deposition of an attorney who drew a previous will. You know, let me just make a couple additional observations insofar as the duty issue is concerned. You know, I can't tell you that the majority view does not say there is a duty. I won't represent that to you because it appears to me it is. In terms of the number of cases one way as opposed to another, I can't tell you what that is. But nevertheless, there are very clear and cogent reasons, and you talked about them in Chemage most recently, as to why a duty should not exist in this case. You know, you're never going to have, or not always going to have, a situation where people have children. You may have a couple that elects for whatever reason not to have had any children. Let's assume that one conveys to the other with a life estate. And just far out the members of the freshman class at the University of Minnesota. What's going to happen under those kinds of circumstances? You know, the obligations you're going to have to potential third parties is going to be limitless. And that is a very, very serious consideration. What do you do under those circumstances? Don't you have to identify then and at that point in time who those people are, where they're going to be? Don't you have to identify the potentiality of their being an heir in an estate? And then, who is your obligation to? Shouldn't the obligation to your client transcend all that? And the moment you start imposing duties to third persons, there is no way you can draw the line. There is absolutely no way. Just to say that the position is a minority position.
Let me interrupt you along that line. Then your duty is to your client to make sure that your client's intent is carried out. Would you agree with that? I mean, that if you're drawing a will or doing an estate. I mean, your duty is to your client to do what they want you to do.
I believe that's correct.
So if your client now, in a case like this, is deceased, who is left if the attorney did not follow through with their duty?
Who is left?
Who's left to, if it isn't the beneficiaries, the third-party beneficiaries, who can bring an action? Or is there just no action that's being brought? Are we eliminating the possibility of an action?
Well, if you don't have the situation that you have here, certainly there are going to be situations, Your Honor, where you aren't going to have an action. That's true. There's no question about it. But what happens in the majority of those cases? What happens is that for whatever reason, the testator, after having executed a will, makes some other decision before his life or death, as a result of which that property is no longer there. Now, I realize you can make all kinds of interpretations of Scoville, but that's essentially what happened there. That property was devised.
Please have a cause of action against Mr. Hogan.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Would the estate of the decedent here have a cause of action against Mr. Hogan under your argument?
No.
Why not?
Under the argument, I guess I'm lost it. What argument?
Under the argument that his heirs were damaged, his estate was damaged. It's diminished by the fact that it was never checked as to where this property was titled or located or whatever, and as a result, the estate for the benefit of these heirs is diminished.
Well, the question you're talking about, that it was not checked, Your Honor, is certainly a question of breach of a duty, a question of standard of care, on which you're going to need some expert testimony. Is there any requirement under the law of the state of South Dakota, the law governing attorneys, whatever it may be, for a lawyer to go out and not be able to take at face value what his client tells him, that he owns specific property, and have an obligation to go out and check it?
Well, isn't that a matter for the jury in determining the merits as to whether or not there was a breach?
No question about that. On the issue of the breach, no question about the issue of proximate cause, no question about the issue of damages. That's what I'm saying. All three of those issues that the appellees have kind of...
You don't claim that the property was put in joint tenancy with the second wife after the will was drawn.
No.
You concede that it was put into joint tenancy with the second wife prior to the drawing of the will.
As is, I recall, some 13 years prior. Almost, well, certainly not to the day. It was probably about 1 month longer than that, or 1 month short of that.
If we adopt this new rule, we're not going to open the door very wide, are we? Because we still have the statute of limitations on malpractice. So a lawyer draws a will 4 years before the decedent dies is not going to be subject to this rule at all, because the statute's going to prevent a suit.
3 years from the occurrence?
Well, what date would we use then? If we didn't use the day that the lawyer drew the will. I mean, we're not extending that with this rule, are we? We're not changing that.
Well, you can't. I know you can do a lot of things, but I can't see that you can do that.
Right. So what I'm saying is the door isn't going to be open very wide, because that three-year statute is still going to foreclose most of the types of potentials that you talked about in terms of unlimited liability to third parties.
I don't think it's going to limit most of the potentials, Your Honor. I think what it'll do, it'll cut them down in terms of time. But within that period, whatever it may be, you're going to have any number of potentials.
But
I don't see how you can foreclose that.
But if you use the restatement, or the first subsection A, it says... It says the lawyer knows that the client intends, as one of the primary objectives of the representation, that the lawyer's services would benefit the non-client. Well, that determines who the non-clients are, doesn't it?
I would think that in the ordinary case, what the lawyer intends to do is to benefit the wishes of the client and see that the will is in accordance with what the client wants. Tangentially, it happens to inure to the benefit of the beneficiaries under the will.
I have one more question about the record. If the record is inadequate to determine that there is a duty, then isn't the record also inadequate to establish the absence of a duty? I mean, your position here today is you're telling us the record's not good enough to determine whether a duty exists. It seemed to me it would apply the other way as well.
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor, because I think it's clear that we had an attorney-client relationship with Mr. Frisk. It's clear that we had an attorney-client relationship with Mrs. Frisk. Notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Hogan may have met with one of the plaintiffs on a previous occasion some years back about their estate, there was no attorney-client relationship existing. So the issue is, if you follow the clear precedent that you have established up to this point in time, there's enough in that record. There is no attorney-client relationship with these beneficiaries, no duty.
Your time's almost out, but I have one question relating to the timing. You moved for summary judgment, pointing that the strict privity rule prevents the Frisky children from maintaining a malpractice action. You never argued to the trial court that any such ruling would be that it would be premature, or that additional facts need to be supported in the record or anything like this, did you?
I don't recall doing that, Your Honor. I think the record is very clear. You've seen the transcript of that hearing. And Acting Judge Miller said at the time, I realize this is a shock to you all. Needless to say, it was. Maybe Mr. Schoenbeck's going to tell you the same thing, but we went up there with every expectation that that was the end of that case, and the court was going to say that there was no duty. Okay. No, so I wasn't arguing at that point, nor was Mr. Madsen on our behalf, suggesting anything about more information needed to be in the record.
Okay, thank you. You've answered the question. Your time's up. Counsel?
Justices,
clerk,
intern, clerk, counsel.
It's an honor to be here before you today. It truly is. And it's particularly an honor because this work, the mental gymnastics involved in discerning the law, is, I think, some of the finest part of the practice of law. It is about trying to decide where we as a society go with the rules that govern us. I will tell you that I believe the briefs that have been done in this case, mine and my compadres, have been inadequate in setting forth how the law has developed in this field. In fact, I think that the ChemAge decision is a much better statement of how the law has developed, and I'm going to take just a few minutes, if I can, and walk you through some of how these, because all of the questions about the theories and the tests, they're interrelated, and we didn't do a very good job in our briefs of tracking that development. In fact, but for oral argument, I wouldn't be able to get up and preparing for that, be able to get up here and do a very good job of that, which I should have done before the first and was put to the first brief. I want to tell you that one of the best treatises that lays it out is the Mallon Smith treatise on legal malpractice and section.
Are these authorities that you're going to rely on now in the theories in your brief, but just say
yes,
improperly done or not fully complete?
Yes, it's in the brief. It's not laid out as well as it could be.
All right.
Mallon and Smith, sections 7.5 to 7.8, you will find a great summary of the development of the law. The way the law develops is you start off first with absolute privity. We all learned that. We all know that Justice Cardozo in 1916 in the McPherson versus Buick Motors case broke the barrier of absolute privity, and yet it kept vitality for many years in the area of attorney malpractice. In fact, this court in ChemAge referred to that as one of the last citadels of absolute privity. What happened, starting in about 1956, the state Supreme Court started looking at this one area where they allowed privity to defeat the potential rights of injured individuals, and they started finding reasons to abrogate, on a limited basis, absolute privity. A number of tests developed, but in the end, the one that ultimately has prevailed, as Justice Meyer-Henry referenced, the third-party beneficiary, has been the theory that is far and away the majority point of view of the states in America that have addressed this. And actually, that has developed two separate tests under third-party beneficiary. Both of them are set out in ChemAge. In paragraph 33 of ChemAge, you will find the American Law Institute test set forth in the restatement, and that is the primary purpose test. In paragraph 34 of ChemAge, you will find a reference to the Flaherty decision of the Maryland Supreme Court. And in fact, set out right at the end of paragraph 34 is a direct quote to that Maryland Supreme Court decision, and that is the intent to benefit test. The intent to benefit test is viewed as a narrower test than the American Law Institute, which is the primary purpose. If you think about it, particularly now, if you discern it down into the most narrow and conservative version of this development of the law, is what Iowa did in the Scoville case, is they used the Flaherty intent to benefit, and they said when you do that in an estate planning contest text, this will be the test. And that's the relief we seek in our brief. It is the narrowest relief that I believe addresses what I will come to in a few moments, are the policy issues, because this is an area that has become more about policy debates than why the law is going where it's going, because there's no...
Mr. Schoendick, malpractice has elements of both contract and tort, and while they have their beginnings in the common law, they've long been codified in our code. When you're talking policy, are you... really arguing to the correct body, or is this a matter for the legislature? They codified the laws of contract and tort.
In the areas of malpractice, the contract and tort concepts become blurred. Third-party beneficiary is actually a contract concept, but it's used in this tort concept. The policy issues I'm referring to are the ones, some of which are set forth in ChemAge, in varying degrees, all of them are set forth in every decision that addresses this, and they're really policies that we as lawyers are concerned about because this affects an area of the law that we uniquely practice in. So I think they're judicial policy issues about the merits or demerits of changing.
On this intent to benefit concept then, would we just look at the face of the document in order to determine intent?
That's what the Iowa court said, and that narrows it to exclude virtually every Pandora's box concern that has been mentioned. I listed nine that I could think of policy reasons for not going where the common law is taking us. The Iowa court virtually gets all of them.
What about the one that involves the confidentiality issue? You know, we all have had clients that come to us for a will or estate planning of some type and say, this is what I want to do, and I don't want this child to know the truth. I'm going to do this and this and this, but I'm going to tell them this. I mean, a lot of times things are done that way, and I haven't been able to work through how an attorney could protect that kind of a communication in this kind of litigation.
Not surprisingly, like a lightning rod, if you list all of the nine reasons that I at least have discerned from counsel's brief, the only one that you just can't absolutely take off the list is the attorney-client privilege, because it is inevitable in that setting that you're going to be, and in this instance, we don't need to know, but we might, because we're looking to the document. What's the intent expressed in the document? But I think it's inevitable in this setting. The attorney-client privilege will come to the forefront. And every one of the 29 states that have adopted this duty have had to struggle with that. And I believe in the end it's the social utility that has led the courts, the great majority of the courts, to say that, and the commentators say this too, it's about trying to enforce the intent of the client. When the client came, the client didn't come and say, I want to draw up a will. That's the end result here with me. It isn't. The end result is to see that their desires are carried out through the will. And so the reason for the cause of action is to provide some mechanism to enforce what the client wanted, to strengthen the intent of the client and enforce it. It is inevitable that there has to be, the one place where there has to be some give is going to be in the area of attorney-client privilege. But it's a focused...
So, can an attorney limit his duty or obligation by the employment contract with the client?
I think he can, and I think even more so what he's going to do, and by the way, all attorneys do this. If there's something a client wants you to do that you have serious questions about, can this work, is this an issue, you would do a letter, and you would say in a letter, I advised you not to do this, or you wanted to do this anyway. Contracts and relationships in all areas, not just the legal world, are done that way. You define the scope. If I could come back, this really at its heart is whether you believe that the civil justice system has social utility. Because this cause of action does two things. It ensures for the client a remedy to see that they get what they sought, and ensures for the profession that we're required to rise to the standard for which we've told our clients we're doing. That's the whole theory behind a tort system of civil justice, is to do that. It's to make the profession affected, it doesn't matter if it's bankers, realtors, lawyers, doctors, to make them be better and to provide remedies for those that are injured.
What about the alternative remedy that may exist with the estate of the decedent?
Justice Gilbertson, there's a couple of problems. One in which I believe maybe the Iowa court noted it, which is and would be true in this case, you've got the stepmom who's the personal representative, and who would have no interest in bringing an action that from a failed will that benefits her, and then you've got in terms of the estate in general, the state isn't harmed. The estate's got every single asset they were supposed to have. It's the if you want the most conservative, most effective to see that you have the right advocates in the courtroom. The named intended beneficiaries frames the issue perfectly.
Couldn't you, representing these children, bring an action to have her removed because of the basic conflict of interest if, in fact, this action is either premature or there are some facts out there that need to be developed?
You could seek that. I had the opportunity to be in nearly a similar position between a current sitting member of this court, and I got slammed.
You did what?
It's an aside that has to do with the Marshall County case. But you'd be going to the trial judge on a completely undeveloped record in an attorney malpractice case and asking the trial judge to kick off the spouse, the surviving spouse, and put somebody else in who may have a case if, in fact, the evidence, which they haven't developed yet, shows it. The cleanest way to frame it, which I believe, you know, some people say the law is an ass. I don't think it is. I think the law makes perfect sense. I think the reason all of these states are moving in this direction is because it perfectly frames the parties with the most succinct cause of action, the most limited fashion, for that which the attorney agreed to do and the service the client purchased.
So is this an evolution of common law? Is that what you're saying?
It is. I mean, we see, when Cardozo wrote in 1916 that absolute privity was falling, I mean, it just took a little longer for it to happen in the area of attorney malpractice. But by 1956, the first state Supreme Court did it. And now there are only five states, and most of those have done it just rotely. They've just said absolute privity, interestingly. Many rely on the Ward, the United States Supreme Court case, 125 years ago, 6-3 decision, in which which one party wanted to sue the attorney for an adverse party, which everybody would agree is a situation which you shouldn't be able to have, and this court mentions it in Kemmage. Adverse relationships would automatically disqualify it anyway. The cases that have weighed through it, through the analysis as Kemmage did, have all virtually come to the conclusion that that's where the common law belongs. There were a couple of comments I would like to address from the prior argument. The reference that some certain conduct was unbeknownst to Mr. Hogan, that's not in the record. The appellants are the ones that moved for summary judgment. The appellants did not argue to the trial court, and it's nowhere in the transcript. Justice Miller, they didn't say that there was insufficient discovery. Justice Miller did not say he was shocked by his decision, and it is true counsel was surprised and made it clear on the record in the courtroom in Brookings County of his displeasure with the Justice Miller's ruling. But they apparently were the only ones surprised by that decision. The ChemH case absolutely walks you through the development of the law. That would be a surprise to no one except this. And interestingly, I was counsel on ChemH as well. That case did not support, the facts weren't present to support the utilization of the duty. And that's what this court said in ChemH. There are no legally significant holes. It is true that we don't know the ages of the decedent or the stepmother, but that's not legally significant. There are no legally significant holes in the record. This is about whether, at the very outset, an attorney would ever owe a duty to somebody for whom he's prepared a testamentary, the beneficiary of somebody named in a testamentary document. The policy issues, and I could briefly touch on, this court raised the importance of protecting the duty of loyalty in a ChemH decision. Well, the rule that is the refinement of Flaherty applied to the estate planning documents absolutely does that. In fact, it encourages the duty of loyalty because it ensures the enforcement of that for which the client sought the legal services. The restatement third says allowing the cause of action promotes the duty to achieve the client's objective. It avoids conflicting duties because it has to be a named intended beneficiary. There isn't this exposure to some other individual not in the will. It does away with an endless group of claimants because it's only the named individuals. And if an attorney is going to, you know, everybody in North America is the residuary beneficiary, they can solve that simply see, there's two ways to solve it. One is you warn the client. The other way is you do the documents correctly. But you have to do one or the other. You can't do neither. And if the client wants to leave it to everybody on Mars, you can do a letter that says, you know what, this isn't going to work, but if you want it, I'll draw it. There are allegations that increase the cost of estate planning. That's not supported in the record, and I don't think that that is intuitively correct. It is the correct. Doing things the right way doesn't cost more. It says the attorney can't limit who they represent or the scope of the representation is an argument that's been raised in the appellate's brief. In fact, they can, if they don't want to do the work, they can not do this field of work or they can do it right. And Justice Inter, you raised what I think is the only policy issue that you actually have to decide if you go with where the common law has gone, and that's the social utility of whether in that narrow area the attorney-client privilege has to step aside. But I will tell you that statutorily, we abrogate, there are exceptions to attorney-client privilege, two of them, which are just so similar to this one that it's amazing. One of them is that if it's a fight over a will, that is an exception to an attorney-client privilege.
Mr. Schoenbeck, as long as we're talking about public policy considerations here, would the effect of adopting your argument basically require practitioners to become specialists in a narrow area and constitute the death knell of a general practitioner?
Yeah, Justice Gilbertson, I don't think so. I speak with some experience in that regard. Well, the standard of care, which is not in this record and wouldn't be unless the duty is a question of law as established by this court, I believe the standard of care will show that you don't believe on a particularly a specific bequest that your client's got the legal description right or that the client knows everything about the, particularly in a second marriage, the ownership status. And right now, practitioners go to the courthouse, get the last couple deeds, check it out. I don't think this demands specialization. I would say this, if it encourages a better degree of professionalism, that's a good thing for society and for the profession. Let
me ask you a question about the difference between the negligence. You brought this as a negligent action.
Yes.
In negligence rather than contract. Is there a difference there, or why negligence and why not contract?
Because in this area, and it's in the decisions that have been handed down by this court as well in this field, that they just get blurred together. And you know, I was reading over last night, I thought, I wonder if somebody's going to ask me the question just asked Justice Meyer Henry, and I hoped you wouldn't, but you did. I'll just tell you that even the commentators, it's blurred in this field because the basis for the action is a contract, but we create a duty over it. It's not any different than what's happened in the area of CPA negligence or claims against realtors. All of those are contractual relationships where we've imposed negligence duties over the top of them.
Except with negligence, you could seek punitive damages.
In the right case, I would say this is not the case that lends itself to that. The undisputed, and by the way, with respect to retroactive application, I think that would be an injustice. I don't, if you look at the, first, that's not the, I mean, the rule is that you apply it retroactively and prospectively, and it would be their burden to show you there'd be some reason not to. Mr. Hogan couldn't have relied upon the prior law because, if you think about that conceptually, it means that he did it wrong or didn't do his job because he knew the prior law protected him. That would certainly be not a social utility that you would want to protect, and it isn't an argument he's made. In fact, while ChemAge was handed down right after he drew the will, prior to that, our court hadn't addressed this particular issue. The great body of common law already existed, though, and it would have said that there would be this duty would exist. And then after ChemAge, if you read ChemAge, I think the conclusion most would come to, it's certainly one Justice Miller came to, was that this court was foreshadowing that that's where the law is developed. It was just that the facts weren't properly presented in that case. So we would encourage the court to apply this retroactively and prospectively, as is the norm for decisions of this court. If I could, in conclusion, I would say that the undisputed record to date is that my clients were the intended beneficiaries of their father's will to receive the family farm, and they were denied that result. That's undisputed in the record. The appellant's brief concedes on page 4 that the will was of no effect under the circumstances as to those transfers of the farm. In ChemAge, this court laid out the legal analysis for the intended beneficiary test. The appropriate facts were not before the court at that time. They are today. I would encourage the court to affirm Justice Miller's decision in this case. The common law is already there. Justice Miller believed that in ChemAge, this court was there. And as a matter of public policy, we deserve to hold attorneys accountable to the same standards that apply to every other profession.
One more question along that line, though. What you are urging the court to do is not to adopt wholesale the restatement with the three subdivisions, but a more narrower intent to benefit from the basing it more on the Iowa decision.
And the Maryland decision. Yes, Your Honor, because I believe the concept of the development of the common law is that you should decide the facts presented, and that's the narrowest decision that addresses the issue. And beyond that, I don't know exactly how courts decide if they want to take a broader point of view or not. Thank you.
Can I please, court? I don't know why the court would ever, in any circumstances, when it has had an opportunity to, before, go back and adopt a case from the Supreme Court of Iowa in 1987, when the restatement now exists. And if there is a principle that is constitute a majority view, it is pursuant to the restatement rather than the Schreiner versus Scoville case that goes back to 1987 in Iowa. You know, I don't want to concede for the purposes of this argument or at any point what this court has previously done. You know, you talk about a restatement provision. Under the so-called restatement of the law governing attorneys, it's probably a page long, the provision itself. It contains in the book on the restatement some 20 pages of illustrations, comments, cases, etc. Now, if that doesn't suggest on its face that the whole idea is rather murky, I don't know what does.
If it's murky, what about Mr. Schoenbeck's suggestion that an attorney can limit his or her exposure by a contract of employment?
Well, if you're talking about duties to third persons, I don't know how you can limit it by a contract of employment.
Well, he conceded, I think, that you could.
I don't believe you can. If you have the duty to third persons, I don't think you can limit that by a contract of employment.
Thank you.
Insofar as the retroactivity is concerned, This will was drafted. It was executed on February 15 of 2002. That was 2.5 or 3 months before ChemAge was even argued. That was the first hint or suggestion that this court may at some point in time be looking at a little different rule. It was 7.5 months until ChemAge came out after that will was executed. Now, under those circumstances, Mr. Hogan and anybody else, for that matter, who was drafting wills at that point in time, did not have a right to rely on the status of the body of law that existed in this state at that time, and again, exists today. That is, there is no duty to third persons, that you only have a duty to the client with whom you have contracted. We would ask you to, yes, reverse this case and remand it with instructions to enter judgment for the defendant. Thank you.
One question. You earlier indicated that that the representative of the estate, the personal representative of the estate, would not have the right to bring an action to enforce the intent of the will. Does that remain your position?
If I indicated that, and then I don't know if that was at the time that Chief Justice Gilbertson asked the question, but if I indicated that, that was not my position, no.
Okay, what is your position?
That you would have that right, that a representative of the estate would have that right.
All right, thank you. All right. We're adjourned until 10 o'clock.